You are listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, episode 175, with the biggest competitions in the world.
Episode 175 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is January the 31st, 2015. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and lining up across the line of scrimmage is my brother, James Furlough.
Dude, that's right.
That's right.
You know, it's early, and that's all I got.
It's very early. Yeah.
Normally, I'm better at this, but... instead of going to bed at a reasonable hour last night,
because it was a Friday,
I don't really have weekends. We decided at 9 o'clock to go to a friend's house to enjoy a little bonfire.
Nice.
And then I woke up at 5:30 this morning so I could finish prepping for this podcast.
Oh man, that's brutal. I was gonna ask what time you finally made your way to bed.
I don't even know. It was around midnight, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe a little after that.
Yeah, because I went to bed at like 12:35, but I didn't have to wake up until 7:45, so it's a bit of a different situation.
That works. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean...
habit of waking up early, but anyways.
Obviously...
We're doing this
Saturday morning, because the big game is tomorrow.
Why don't you just pick a team? Spoiler alert, since people will be listening to this afterwards. In retrospect, I'm a little slow this morning. In retrospect, we should have just pretended like we knew who won.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man, it's crazy that the... See, my problem is I can't pick one. People have been asking all week, who are you hoping would win? And I keep saying, you know, I know it's unprecedented, but I kind of hope they both lose.
Or at the very least, each of them suffer a very big injury. I would prefer the Patriots lose.
You're one of those Southwestern...
I'm rooting for a team to lose. There's a difference.
Yeah. I think I'm on the same page. I'm going to be happy no matter which team loses.
So I was...
but I think if I had to...
Hold on a second. Wait.
Are you fixing your audio?
Yeah, okay.
It's driving me crazy.
Yeah, well, all of a sudden I realized it because I was like, dude, stop talking. But I was listening to this this interview that they do before the Super Bowl, and they essentially had both of the head coaches up and were talking to them. And, number one, Pete Carroll's actually a pretty funny guy, which is good.
Yeah.
He's more fun to listen to because he'll tell jokes, which is nice. One of the cornerbacks, his wife is pregnant and she's supposed to like give birth during the Super Bowl or something like that. And, you know, so I was like, is he going to play or is he going to watch his son being born? What's he going to do? And so Pete Carroll's like, you know, and they were asking him like, what's up with that? And he's like, well, because honestly, family comes first and I'm going to support whatever choice he makes. You know, if he wants to go watch his kid be born, that's awesome. I'm going to celebrate with him. He goes, and you know, I'm excited to see little Petey after the game. And they're like, nice. Just little comments like that. You're like, oh, pretty funny guy. And then you have Belichick where, you know, he's kind of more stoic and gruff, I guess. And someone asked him about the whole, like, how are the refs going to signal who's an eligible receiver? And he's like, that's not my job. Ask a ref. Next question.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, geez. He's a competitor through and through.
Yeah. It's funny with the whole, like, this is probably way too far into the weeds of sports talk for a tech podcast. But, you know, it's the Super Bowl weekend. Just deal with it. Everybody's doing it, okay? We get to do it, too.
Yeah.
There's a big data analysis that I thought was fascinating where they somebody broke down number of fumbles by teams and specifically the Pats. And there was this – there up to like 2006, the Pats sort of had this – their rate of fumbles was on par with everybody else. Very, very standard for the league. And then in 2006, there was this really dramatic change where they basically stopped fumbling. Their average fumbles went way, way, way down compared to everybody else. That happened to coincide a rule change that was pushed by the Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning and the Pats quarterback. What's his name? Cheater.
Thomas Brady.
Yeah, Tom Brady. And pretty Tom Brady. And the rule change was that the quarterbacks or the team gets to supply their own balls. And so the prep work can be done. You know, they can be one of the things that you could do is the quarterback could pressurize them to their ideal pressure. And so it's one of those things where it's like, they got that rule change pushed through, and all of a sudden, the Pats stopped fumbling ever. Which, you know, like, you sit there and go, it's legal. And, like, clearly, if you were to warm them up in a really, really warm room and then take them out to a really cold field like they did, and in the warm room, they were right at the bottom end of where you could pressurize them and they drop pressure. I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like, it's so clearly what they do. They just, like, and what bothers me is that it's a Bill Belichick thing. Like, he does everything in his power to push the. I really like coaches that use the rule book like another player on the field. Like, I respect that when you got a coach that knows the rule book so well that they can like do stuff that everybody else goes, is that even legal? And then everybody goes, oh my gosh, that is legal. I can't believe you can do that. A problem with Bill Belichick is that he always seems to push it just beyond that. Like, you know, just to the other edge of what's actually allowed and into the territory of what's clearly not allowed. It really bothers me.
Or at least they go, that wasn't even kind of remotely the intent when we made that rule.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with we all know that there's going to be a rule change about the eligible receiver as a result of what he did, because they're like, that wasn't the intention behind it. You're literally taking advantage of a loophole that you're smart enough that you thought about it and no one else had. And we're in the middle of the season and we're not going to stop you. But
it's funny. That's the sort of thing I kind of respect. It's the if you find the loophole and you get to take advantage of it and they need to change a rule, I'm okay with that. That's kind of cool.
That's fair. That's very Andrew Wiggin of you. That's fair.
Yeah. Well, part of it is our high school football coach used to do that kind of garbage all the time.
That's true.
And I always liked it because I liked winning. And I understood where that mentality came from.
I remember on more than one occasion where like he literally had like a little mini rule book in his pocket. And every once in a while, I would bust it out and walk over to the refs and be like, look, it says right here.
I'm allowed to do this.
You're just like, whoa, he just busted that out. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And I sit there.
With friends, but you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Not what he wants.
But he won a lot of games. That was the important part. You know, but it's the.
The ball one. I agree.
Yeah. I just, whatever. Honestly.
Congrats to the team that won. We knew you could do it. We had confidence in you. It was a well-fought game.
You didn't deserve it, but
the commercials were pretty good. The halftime show was different than we've ever seen before. Hopefully you enjoyed the snacks and time with family.
Yeah, yeah.
Get back to work.
Yes. Stop talking about it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, if the Patriots win, no one will be talking about it where I live, so that's okay.
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody will be talking about it one way or another. unless what I hope for happens and they both lose. fingers crossed. So you know what, James, but this week we're not here to talk about football or the Super Bowl or all that fun stuff. This week, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera, and by that we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure that he'd like to throw your way.
Yes, I work for the future HP Inc. However, I do not represent the future HP Inc. or any of the future HP Inc.'s opinions.
Nice. And for the record, not the current one either, right?
not the current one either.
Awesome. I would like to disclose that I am a major stakeholder in Facebook, the company. They're sucking down all my profits that I had over the last couple of weeks. I've decided that
I did call on the stock to sell, by the way.
I sold my, obviously last week I sold my Apple stock right
live
before,
on the show.
Yeah, right before the price tanked coming into the earnings call, and then I didn't buy it at the price tank. I decided to wait it out, which we will talk about later why that was not necessarily the worst decision nor the best decision I've ever made. I bought Facebook stock after their earnings call, which, once again, was not necessarily the worst mistake, but not necessarily the best decision I could have made. But anyways, I've decided that this is kind of what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to own some tech stock every week of various sorts, just so that I'm paying attention, because it's just impossible to make any real money on it at the dollar amounts that I'm playing with. So it's just kind of for fun, so I pay attention. But you know what? If you want to find out more about this sort of stuff, just not on the weekend, you want to hear like our thoughts and see pictures and stuff throughout the week, there's a way to do that. Our lives don't end when we stop airing, believe it or not. And to what? Find out more about our lives really? Don't end. Yeah, I know. I say, did they not tell you?
Was it, I just sit here and wait until the next show.
Oh man. It sounds like more fun than what I do sometimes, honestly. if you want to follow us throughout the week, though, and see more about our exciting and adventurous lives, you can go to Twitter. That's where I'm at, Matthew D. Furlow. Or you can go to Insta, IG, the Facebook subsidiary. And my tag there is NextWiggin4 with two G's and a number.
So you don't have a Twitter replacement yet, huh?
Not yet. Okay. I'm thinking about it. I'm still contemplating.
All right. I am at James Furlow on Twitter, James Furlow on Instagram, jamesfurlow.com. And that's about it.
Cool. If you want to follow us throughout the week, if you want to know more about the show, geez. You know what? It is early. Early on a Saturday morning, okay? If you want to know more about the show, you can go to furloughbros.com. Pretty cool little world there. All of the older shows, all the links to the YouTube, all the links to the podcast, and all the links to all the articles we're going to talk about today. So if there's anything you want to drill down more on, see more information, catch up on, whatever, go check it out, furloughbros.com. It's pretty cool. Do that. I recommend it.
That is a good recommendation.
Thank you.
Oh, man. I am pumped. 15 minutes in. Let's talk about tech.
All right. So I'm up first, yeah? Okay. Cool. So have you used Music Key yet?
Music Key?
Yeah, Google Music Key. You muted as soon as you started typing.
Music key. In music theory, the key of a piece is the tonic note and chord, which gives a subjective sense of arrival and rest, Other notes and chords in the piece create varying degrees of tension, resolved when the tonic note and or chord returns.
Yes, that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh, the next link is YouTube Music Key.
There we go.
All right, Music Key Beta, a new way to enjoy music ad-free anytime, anywhere. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so basically what it is it's through YouTube. YouTube, obviously, we've talked about this over the generations of this show, that one of the cool things YouTube has got going for it is that everybody listens to their music there. And it's one of those things where it's kind of weird because obviously it's, you know, people will make like playlists of YouTube videos and then play in the background. That's where a lot of kids were listening to their music because it was free and they don't understand anything about bandwidth. And
<They don't care.
laughs> but it allowed them to, it gave them huge control over the music. There's obviously a ton of music on YouTube, and so kids are using it for that. And Google decided to finally do something about that, and so they introduced what they call Music Key, which is basically, it's a paid subscription, like $10 a month, and it gives you effectively two things when you pay that $10 a month. Number one, it gets rid of all ads for music. So no more ads before movies or before the video play, stuff like that, which is nice. It's sort of it's the Pandora or Spotify style control. But the other big thing is that it opens up a functionality in your YouTube app on your Android phone or your iPhone that will allow the audio to keep playing in the background. Which is something that you used to be able to do, but they killed that functionality for the, you know, because otherwise it just became a music player. And now they're returning that functionality after you pay $10 to become a music player again. And so this is, you know, this is part of Google's strategy to coming up with a competitive music streaming service to Spotify and iTunes Radio and the like. So
that's an interesting backdoor approach.
It is. And it's actually really super complicated. And one of the reasons why it's really super complicated is because musicians like are asking, you know, like, where are the lines? What are they doing? So one of the things that, you know, like, what constitutes music? Because Google has kind of legendarily allowed users to do stuff like, if you're a musician and you're playing, like you have a song that's copyrighted, you own it, and somebody else uploads that song and includes it in a video of them doing, you know, cartwheels on a trampoline, that's your copyrighted material. If they're making money off of that video, how do you get paid, right? And so Google has this huge infrastructure of built into their, as you upload videos, they scan your stuff and they basically do a Shazam on your video and have it look up what songs. Yeah. Or look up what songs.
ID, right?
Yeah. It's called, yes, it's not content ID. It's music ID. It's something ID. Shoot. Yeah, no, you're right. Content ID. Okay. I'm just going to listen to you next time. So it's called Content ID. So what happens is if you're a if you're a musician, you get a YouTube account, you upload your music, you tell Google, hey, this is my copyrighted material. If anybody uses it, do something about it. Sometimes that's an automatic, they pull down the video. Sometimes that means that, and mostly that means, though, that if that video gets played of the person doing cartwheels, it makes $5, then, you know, the content owner gets whatever cut they get. It's a pretty cool system, and a lot of musicians, especially independent musicians, use that system. One in particular, the cellist, Zoe Keaton, Zoe with two little dots over the E in her name. I don't know. I think that means I'm pronouncing it wrong, but I don't know how to pronounce it.
Zoe.
Zia.
Zoe.
So, and she had been doing specifically that. So what would happen is she'd have her music. If you clicked on her YouTube video and it was just her playing it, there were no ads. She didn't make any money off of it. Google didn't make any money off of it. It was just there. But if somebody else used her movie or music and made money off of it, then she would get a cut of that. It was a pretty cool system for her. She got to push her music out to her fans the way she wanted to. You could buy it on iTunes before it made its way to YouTube. If you wanted her most recent stuff. But for most fans, they could get it for free on YouTube. And then, but if anybody else used the music, she got money for that too. So it worked out well for her. But Google is changing all that, and she's not happy. And I think this is just an interesting strategy that they're taking. They're basically saying anybody who has a content ID, so all of the musicians on their service, they're changing the terms of service. If you want to continue to use your content ID, you got to change some stuff up. And this is kind of how it breaks down. The new music service agreement covers my content ID account, and it includes mandatory participation in YouTube's new subscription streaming service called Music Key. Along with all that participation entails, here are some of the items I have problems with. Number one, all of my catalog must be included in both the free and premium music service. Even if I don't deliver all my music because I'm a music partner, anything that a third party uploads with my info in the description will be automatically included in the music service too. So she basically loses all control over what's streamed for free, what gets paid, which is interesting for her because she wants to be able to give it away for free without any ads. She wants to, you know, low friction to her users. But obviously, if there's something you wanted to make money off of or, you know, something like that, you wouldn't get control over that as an artist if you're uploading to YouTube. All songs will be set to monetize, meaning there will be ads on them, period. Don't go choice. Three, I will be required to release new music on YouTube at the same time I release it anywhere else. So no more releasing to my core fans first on Bandcamp and then on iTunes, which is a really interesting thing considering like what Beyonce just did with her latest album where she released it early on iTunes. Now, according to this, she wouldn't be able to use content ID with her music on YouTube. So if there was another Beyonce song, if there was a third party that was using a Beyonce song and she wanted to get paid for it, she can't pre-release it on iTunes. I'm sure she's actually worth enough money where she might be able to negotiate privately with YouTube. But, you know, in principle, it still kind of stinks, you know, because there's a lot of reasons to do that sort of stuff. Number four, all my catalog must be uploaded at high resolution according to Google standard, which is 320 kilobyte beers. It's interesting. It's an interesting tactic that Google is taking, sort of strong-arming. You know, they basically offered this free, really convenient service for content creators forever. And then once they had this giant user base of users and content creators sort of communicating back and forth, then they just one day flipped the switch. And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, now you play by our rules. Right? And I think it's interesting because number one, it's like you're gonna flatten everybody on this because anybody who's big enough, all the Beyonces of the world, Katy's, Harry's, your Taylor's, Swift, they're gonna be able to privately negotiate with YouTube to get whatever deal they need to get. But for most people, man, they're just going to turn this into a giant service that nobody will be able to say no to, which is pretty clever. But it does make you wonder about, like, other things where, you know, the nature of YouTube in general with all of the different content creators. Is there a day when they decide to turn that into a full-on network TV station and all of a sudden – you know, these content creators, they just wake up one morning and they're like, hey, by the way, a classic Lando Calrissian, we had a deal. I altered the terms of the deal. Pray that I don't alter it further. You know, It's just not a good analogy that you want to be drawing. You don't want to be compared to Darth Vader, okay?
Yeah, as a general rule, I would say that is very true. very true. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's just
I don't fully know what to make of it yet.
But I don't either. I don't think it's a horrible thing. I mean, if it majorly upsets your particular way of distributing your music, that's rough. I feel for you. But I'm not sure that in principle, you know, that's a big enough group of people for it to really bother anybody. And you know, like you said, it's good to be king. They've got this new service that they've got to make work, and that requires a certain amount of across-the-board participation, and so this is how they're going to achieve it. But you know, like I said, it does make you wonder. The other thing that you know that is difficult about this is, especially when it comes to content creators in the music industry, man, they got so many tight contracts that sometimes Google may not actually want to do this. This may not be in their best interest. But it was the only way that they could get the big music studios to sign on, was to say, yes, everybody's going to play by this particular set of rules. We're all going to play together, or, you know, they don't get anything. And, you know, Google, because that's happened to a lot of times when Apple gets really beaten up for their policies on, you know, digital rights and stuff, and how to use the iPod. A lot of that had as much to do with the studios' contracts as anything, not Apple's personal, you know, belief system. I don't know. It's interesting. Like you said, I'm not exactly sure what to make of it. I just wanted to bring it to your attention, and I'm sure we'll keep paying attention to it as time goes on.
Yeah. I don't think it'll work. I think she made a big enough stink that something's going to change. It'll go more. You know, clearly one of those things where it was made by engineers. Lawyers got involved. And Google's an aggressive company in general.
Right.
And they're going to make assumptions and push for certain, they're going to push for something until someone pushes back. And now they have, I think you'll see them be a little more like, okay, all right, you know, we'll play nice. I mean,
yeah,
it's an interesting idea. And it's one of those where clearly they saw that the pest guy is here, so we may have some interruptions.
Okay.
Jesse's going to take care of it.
Awesome.
A little distracting on my end. Okay.
It's a little bit distracting on our end, too.
Okay. Good. I'm glad I'm not alone on this. What was I just talking about?
And they're going to change. They're going to get better.
Yeah. So they saw an opportunity and were like, how can we capitalize on this? What's already going on? And they took a first pass at it. They were like, let's go for broke. And they'll retract on it. The other nice part about the internet is that it self-balances and self-corrects. But yeah, thanks for letting us know, keeping us updated. I did think that was very, very interesting. I think your other point, you know, you just kind of made it in passing, is YouTube on their way to becoming a cable company?
Yeah.
And, you know, coinciding that news was that YouTube and Google are going to get NFL video highlights on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, they're kind of started to think in that direction, which makes sense. You know, that's what you would do, of course. But
yeah, you're one of the most watched things in the world, you know.
Yeah, you just gotta be careful. You don't break what made you special.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like, do you remember? We talked about this like, man, it was forever ago. But it was this guy. He made a dating site, and you know, one of those like just. What?
I thought it was Plenty of Fish.
Maybe it was. I don't remember. But he like coded it up in a weekend, you know? Yeah. And the thing just like took off. And he was just making hand over fist money and was like essentially running this site all by himself. Maybe like one or two other people.
Yeah.
And so he was like, dude, this is amazing. And so he started investing in the site and, you know, prettied it up, made it look nicer. And all of a sudden it tanked on him. He was like, what the heck? You know, and it turned out that he cut it up in a weekend and it didn't do the profile pictures right. It all stretched them and made them weird.
Yeah.
And so you had to click on the link to see the picture because all you got was this like stretched blob of a person. And then once he improved it, you didn't have to click anymore because you could just see the profile picture correctly.
So
ad revenue based, you know, click through, whatever. And all of a sudden people weren't clicking and they weren't spending, they weren't spending near as much time on his site. And so he had to break it again. in order to get back to what that was. You know, and the other one was all of the paid services, they would advertise on his site because this was free because they were like, come, we've got real algorithms and a better interface and whatever. So they were the ones who were funding him. And, you know,
that's
and
then awesome. He was
like, get better. And they're like, we're not paying for that. And, so you just kind of wonder, you know, so far YouTube hasn't succumbed to that particular issue, but you see stuff like this where it's like, man, they're improving it. They're making things better. But at the same time, to do that, they're killing other things.
Yeah.
And just kind of, you know, they had this music ecosystem going on and they liked it. So they're like, let's try to quote unquote improve it. And
just like they did with Inbox.
Yeah. Inbox. I dislike Inbox.
Yeah.
So here's what I noticed, just total side note since you brought it up. I've stopped using it because I couldn't – my inbox was fuller than normal.
Really?
I didn't understand the sorting algorithm, and I couldn't go through them as fast, and it would hide how many emails I had. And the worst part was you couldn't mark something as unread once you read it. So it's like, I don't understand. So anyways, it's just like – just super frustrating. It was actually less – it made it harder to use. I'm like, no, it should go the opposite direction. And we'll talk about an app later on. Here's your tease that actually does that for
– nice.
For Gmail on the iPhone. All right. YouTube. Cool. I feel like
– used to.
We'll put a bow on that. You know, there's kind of a – there's a theme, this Saturday morning, if you will.
Yeah.
It's the versus theme. You know, we've got Patriots versus Seahawks. You've got Google versus music artists. and there's a bunch of those that happened this week. You've got Twitter versus Facebook and WhatsApp. Twitter even versus Snapchat. Snapchat versus Facebook and their users. Tumblr versus Medium. Just a whole bunch of companies going after each other, which is kind of fun and exciting, and that's why we're here. And so the first one that I want to talk about is the company that is quickly becoming dead to you, Twitter.
Yeah.
So they rolled out a couple new features this week. Are these going to be enough to reel this big fish we call Matthew Furlow in? Hmm. So you'll have to tell me if this is compelling or not. Here it is. Ready for the first one?
Yes.
Group direct messaging.
So they're going to bring text messaging to Twitter?
Well, they've always had DMs. They've always had that. But now you can do it with a group of people.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, that's
it's private.
Okay, that's cool. Why did they not?
Group.
I'm not even – I see – to me, this is my problem. That's literally –
more than one. I don't think you fully understand the concept here. More than one people in your message. I guess more than two technically.
You know what my problem is? If I wanted to do that, I would have noticed that I wasn't able to do that. But I didn't notice I wasn't able to do that on Twitter because I've never needed or wanted to do that. Like –
Exactly. You didn't know it. You needed it until it was here.
Yeah.
And now that it's here, it's so compelling you have to do it, right?
Right. No.
Now that I've told you about this concept, are you just like...
The problem with that is
if you are... This is what I've been looking for.
If you are a power user and use Twitter exclusively, then yeah, I guess that would be nice. But I'm not and I don't, so... And I feel like most people are kind of on the same board. We're all – the problem is that everybody who you're friends with on, like, Twitter are it's not a good social – it's not a strong social network. It's more of a content delivery system right now. And it's just there's plenty of ways – direct messaging is all about your social network because, whether it's your text message or Snapchat or Facebook or whatever – you're talking about people you know directly. I don't know. That's weird. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, cool. I'm just surprised, A, that they didn't have that functionality, and B, that I never knew that they didn't have that functionality. So I'm not sure I...
Okay. All right. Fair enough. How about this next one then? This one's got to work for you. This is so dynamic. All right. Here's what you do. You take a video... your phone.
As I am wont to do.
Directly to Twitter.
Cool.
You don't go to YouTube. You don't go to Facebook. You don't go to Vine. You don't go to Instagram. And then have to link back to it. You just go straight to the hose. And then it's embedded in there for others to click and watch native. How about now? Are you in?
No. For a power user, somebody who uses it as a way to get content out, that's an important feature, and it's a good thing that they've done it.
Edit the videos. Does that help?
Not me in particular.
You can even capture the videos in-app.
See, the thing is, so this is my thought. It's like, it's one of those things where it's like, they're not late to the table on this one. Really and truly, Facebook only included that functionality in the last year. And, because it's a technical challenge. They built Vine as a sort of, as their solution to this, as a separate piece of it. They worked out all the technology. I'm sure it's the exact same technology that Vine runs on, just without the 6-second limit. Because if it's not, why the heck not? I don't know. I think it's interesting.
30 seconds.
Well, yeah. So it's literally Vine, but branded as Twitter with a longer chunk of video. Yeah, it's a good thing that they've done it.
Table stakes, a requirement. It was more like missing, and now they've added it. You're like, okay, good. Now you're catching up.
Right, and it's not a...
Kind of like cut and paste on a certain smartphone at one point in time.
Exactly. But at the same time, it's not like they're way behind the ball on this one. I don't think people were... Well, yeah. I think if they had waited another year, it would have been like, what are you doing? What are you doing with your lives? Why are you so far behind? At the same time, Twitter has always been a, link to other content. Share a video of... A YouTube video, not share a Twitter video. So I don't know if that's – I actually don't know that that's a huge deal. It's good that they have it, but I don't think it was a requirement for them either just because of how people use Twitter.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with what you're saying. Twitter's a weird beast, man. I like it for content discovery. And so, honestly, I use it for, two ways. Number one, I've got specific friends or people that I follow, and I actually get, alerts whenever they tweet it out. Whenever you tweet, I see it. Pops up on my watch and my phone.
Nice.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're in your circle there.
It must be inundated with alerts from me.
Oh, yeah, totally am. Not anymore, because you don't do it. But, you gotta get on the if this then that train, dude. Because then you do stuff other places, and it just auto populates your tweet stream for you.
Yeah,
that's what I do. And then the other thing that I use it for is content discovery. And so I've created these lists that I have that might be about like personal finance or real estate or health stuff, whatever. And I've created these lists. But then what I do is I subscribe to those lists. Man, I can do this. Lists. That's a weird word right now. Inside of Flipboard. And I'll actually hop over to Flipboard and I'll flip through tweets/stories. And if I'm interested, I'll click on it and it automatically embeds everything for me anyways.
Huh.
That's how I use it. And I'm thinking like, okay, is this compelling enough for me to not use Flipboard and just look at my lists inside of Twitter? And it's like, answer's no, but I don't know. I don't get the DM thing either. I'm kind of like, I feel like text messaging solved that.
Well, you know, the nice part about it is if you follow celebrities or something and somehow, you know, I guess I can see, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think it's a stupid function that nobody will use. I think people will use it. It's just, I'm not surprised that nobody uses it yet or nobody like, I guess I'm not super surprised that it's taken them this long, and I don't think it's designed for most people. It's designed for a very small subset of their users that, you know, coordinating tweet storms or something. I don't know. I don't know what you use it for. Seems crazy to me, but.
All right. Keep trying, Twitter. Keep trying. Okay. All right. I got one for you now.
Thank you. I do hear that.
It's just some background noise. Hopefully YouTube doesn't pick it up as content ID and block us.
It's like a phone ringing.
It's a phone alarm.
Oh.
That's going off. Hello. Oh, I can there you are. Your phone's totally going off. She's just chilling.
That's
my
funny.
Wife is deaf. Okay. pregnant.
She's color.
When you're pregnant, is that how that works?
Mm.
Okay. Hey, shh, shh. We're recording, please.
This is super important. Okay.
Yeah. Silence. All right. It's a Saturday morning. I love it.
It's so difficult for us to focus right now. This is so hilarious.
I know. It's like you can't do it Sunday night because I'm just like, I'm tired and I have to constantly eat and drink something, water, to stay awake. And now I'm just like, I'm in this haze of it's the morning, whatever. Okay. Let's talk about Snapchat because they also released.
They shut down their service? They closed the doors? They gave up?
Exactly. Yes.
You know what's disappointing? When they finally collapse and give up, we won't even mention it because it'll just be such a dead story. It'll go the way of BlackBerry where, you know.
You know, I keep hoping that everything about Snapchat is ephemeral, including their business.
Yeah. Oh, I think it is, but go on.
Well, they are They're not standing still. Let me put it that way.
Well, they better not.
So do you know anything about what is it they did this last week?
A little bit.
Okay, a little bit. All right. So Snapchat launched Discover. Okay. So the way this works is, and I'll walk you through it. I'm opening up. Not the app yet, but I'm opening up the app. So you open up the app, and normally when you do, it gives you the camera. Mm-hmm. Right, you snap a picture and then you share it.
That is a traditional thing for them to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's got a little ghost up top, which are your friends' contacts or something. I don't know. Apparently, I don't have any, so that's cool. Then you have you have stories that people can create, and you can add friends and make stories. And again, I don't fully get it, but if you swipe to the right. No, wait.
To the right.
Do that long enough, you will eventually come upon a new page called Discover.
Ah, CNN, Comedy Central, Snapchat, ESPN.
Yep, People, Yahoo News, Vice, Food Network, and so forth. So if you choose one, like let's say National Geographic, you tap on it, and you get a little logo thingy, and then you're presented with a headline and some photos that are moving around on it. And then if you're like, okay, and it says like this one is called Photos, Pure Hawaiian, See Stunning Photos of Hawaii's Surfing Culture. Go, okay, I'm interested. You swipe up, and it's an article, just like anything else.
That's awesome.
Really cool photos, and which they promised, so I'm glad they held up to that promise. And then so you read it, you read it, you read it, you swipe, and then eventually you get to the bottom, and then you can swipe left to, or what is it, right to left again, and it's another one, Unexpected Shark Blows Explorer's Mind. And this one actually has a video. Oh, wait, there's an ad.
Dude.
Did I mention there's ads?
Dartmouth.
No, this is a video, and so you can sit there and watch the video. And whatever, it's kind of cool. You do the next one. It's talking about galaxies, and you can explore the wonders of the universe. Again, it's more like an article. Swipe again. To what island was Napoleon Bonaparte exiled after the Battle of Waterloo? You have a choice of – wow, I cannot like – hold on 1 second. I'm going to drink some water. What do you think of your answer? All right. A, Elba. B, Patmos. That's probably not right. Patamos. C, Devil's Island. Or D, St. Helena. Do you know the answer?
Say it one more time.
Pop quiz. To what island was Napoleon Bonaparte exiled after the Battle of Waterloo? Elba? Patamos? I don't think I said that right. Patmos? Devil's Island or St. Helena?
I feel like it was Devil's Island.
Devil's Island C? Let's see. All you do is you swipe up, and the answer is D, St. Helena. After being defeated at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, the French leader was exiled to the island of St. Helena by the British. He lived there for 6 years before dying at age 51. Napoleon was earlier exiled to Elba, but he escaped in less than a year and returned to power. Swipe again, and you're on to another story or video. So the whole idea here, and I have no idea, honestly, how to get out of this.
That's funny.
If you scroll all the way up, you kind of get back to the Discover tab. So again, these are curated news articles hosted by Snapchat, where they've got articles, they've got videos, they've got quizzes, nothing super interactive. But they are all custom made for Snapchat. It's not just like an RSS feed ported into it. It's a little more thought out than that. And P.S., once they upload a story onto Snapchat, it's only there for 24 hours, and then it's gone.
It's ephemeral.
It is ephemeral.
It's funny. I think it's interesting that originally they sort of thought of themselves as wanting to be more of a social network, and I think they've realized that they're not that, and there are certain struggles with just the nature of their application and their service that prevents them from being that. So they've decided, well, let's be a content site, and not a content curation, but an actual content provider, an initial source. And which is a good move on their part. It definitely will increase the likelihood that people will resonate on the page because, why did people go to Snapchat? Because there was content. Who was the content provider? Well, it was the content creator. So it was your friends. And I think you're probably, and once again, maybe I'm too old for this, but I keep polling friends and asking people and doing my kind of continual market research of asking, where people are with Snapchat. And across the board, everybody I talk to experiences the same thing, which is, I don't use it as much as I used to. My power users still post every once in a while, but, the casual people who only ever posted once in a while, they never post. And the power users that used to, shoot me a Snapchat 3 times a day, they're only snapping me once or twice a week now. And which is causing, if people aren't producing as much content, then people use the app less and less and less, obviously. And so, you know, by creating this content that's guaranteed to be there, it lasts for 24 hours. It's sort of like one of their timeline, storyline things. But for official content, and, you know, ESPN is is creating the content, I sit there and I go, you know, it's a good strategy for them. And I don't think there's a huge perk to the whole, it's only there for 24 hours and it's gone, though. I don't think that's going to draw people. I think that's an annoyance. They're trying to shoehorn what it is they do into this type of content. You know, what's the advantage of that? Why do I, as a user, all that does is force me to only have 24 hours to come and check it out. I guess what my point is the only real selling point to this new service that they've got is that it's the only place you can get this content. So if there's a provider that is writing this specifically for Snapchat, it's an article and that you like and all they do is post on Snapchat, then I could see you become a regular user despite it being annoying that it's only there for 24 hours, not because of it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Were you reading articles on Snapchat?
Actually, I was watching the video of the guy setting the world record for most single hand catches. it's a pretty compelling little app. my biggest problem is they don't send me notifications. So how do I? I'm just gonna forget.
You know, yeah,
it's hidden away in some swipes. Yeah, I'm gonna look at it 3-4 times and then I'll be done.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny. I still use it to send money. I think that's fun.
Yeah, and I from everything that I've read, people are like, that's actually innovative and different and unique. They're like, publishers. Big deal. Like, from a back-end standpoint, that publishers are actually willing to host their content on there, they go, that's a big deal. Like, but that's like insider baseball stuff. Users don't care.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what Facebook wanted to do. They're like, guys, let us host your stuff for you. And, you know, publishers are like, no.
Yeah, that's a terrible idea. We're not going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No. But, you know, if anything, Snapchat's
so
I have a threat, just like iTunes. But
I haven't opened Snapchat in like 3 days, okay, and maybe 4, and I don't have a single snap from anybody except Team Snapchat.
Really?
Yeah, nobody's sending me snaps anymore.
Snapchat's dead, dude. Oh, are you pumped about this?
I don't know. Well, like I said, I might be the wrong user. It might just be my user group. But for my user, for my age group, for my demo, it is definitely no longer the cool club. Kids have decided to move on to the next cool club. And I think, you know.
You're welcome. I just sent you a snap.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Was it money?
Maybe.
I don't want it then.
I know.
Hey, yeah, check.
Look to find out.
Not money. Definitely not money. I appreciate that. I'm not snapping you back.
That's fine.
You know, I don't know. I guess it. You know, I still think it was a brilliant single function app. I still think it was one of the best single ideas that anybody's come up with in a long time, and I think as part of a bigger service, it's definitely awesome. I think, like, I keep thinking that Apple's got it included in iMessages, Facebook has got to build it into their messaging service, everybody's got to build that ephemeral thing in there. Problem is, it's now patented, and so everybody's got to be very careful about how they implement it so that they don't step on Snapchat's toes and get sued.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that what's going to end up happening is Snapchat, you know, man, I still can't believe he passed on Zuckerberg. I mean, the guy will be rich for the rest of his life, the CEO, because he'll be able to get another job and start another, even though he's not going to end up actually having any money from Snapchat at the end of the day, maybe a little bit when they sell it. But they've got to pay back all their...
You really do not like them. That's hilarious.
I don't like him. I think he's a bad engineer. I think he's, like, he just has so much hubris, it's disgusting. And, you know, it's just, you know, he's just... it's like their whole UI. Their whole UI is built on all sorts of design language that nobody uses. And every time they update, they include some, like, some new functionality that isn't communicated to anybody. And you know, I'm the sort of person that nobody shows me something on iOS that I don't know. I show people tips and tricks. I spend time learning all the weird ins and outs and discovering stuff. And Snapchat, like, continually, I find stuff where I'm like, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know that was how you did that. And A, I don't like feeling that way. But B, that's because you're B, you know, I'm speaking of hubris. But the problem is that it's like they're trying to innovate these new control settings that aren't needed, that aren't required. They're just different to be different. And the app was unstable for so long. And it just, I don't know. I'm just never been impressed by the company. I've never been impressed by them. And I think they, you know, I think they really got ahead of themselves, but whatever.
It's, man, for me, it's one of those things where it just, I don't want to say it. It feels like it should be big.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, you're like, I don't want to give them anything. because you don't like the people running it. And it's almost like frustration that they landed on a good idea and
squandered it.
Not necessarily squandered it. I mean, it's just, I don't know. You're bugged by the person and they're winning, doing well, and you're upset about it almost.
Well,
it's like one of those where it's like, it's a good idea. I wish someone else had thought of it.
Oh yeah, exactly. It is a brilliant idea. And I, you know, he's not like the guys who started, what's it called? Tinder that seem everybody's pretty sure are at least womanizers, if not worse. You know, like when it comes to their opinion of people and how they treat people, which is pretty disgusting. And you know, we don't get deep into it on the show just because it's, you know, it's a little bit heavy for what we do, but I know, but once again, a brilliant idea by kind of terrible people. But at the same time, I don't know, it's like the whole culture of the app. Whereas I feel like I don't know, with Snapchat, it's just like, it could have been something. It could have been something if they just would have played well with others. But he refused to. And I guess that's what it is. I don't want to live in a world where somebody can execute a brilliant idea poorly, all on their own, struggle into the world, and then succeed. I want to live in a world where, no, you have to play well with others. You have to execute brilliantly, even on a brilliant idea. A brilliant idea is just the spark of a giant fire. It is not the fuel. And I want to believe that it requires more. It probably says a lot about me and my opinion on what it takes to build great things. Because it would be so frustrating if you could just get by with a really, really great idea, and that it meant that in my entire life, the only thing I've been missing is a great idea. Because I know that's not what I'm missing.
Yeah.
I'd much rather believe that it's my inability to work with other people or my ability to execute brilliantly that's preventing me. I don't, you know, and this isn't about me though, James. This is about Snapchat and how much we hate them.
All right, well, let's move on.
Okay, definitely. So, I'm...
Cool company we love.
Yeah. So, you know, why do we always talk about Apple? This has been a fun week for the stock market, if you're invested in it. And by that, I mean I hate everything right now. now that I have a fiscal stake in it. It's like $20. It goes back and forth $20, and it drives me insane. I can't believe I get this bothered about that little amount of money. So Apple had their earning call this month or this week, and if you weren't following, they made some good coin. It was the most it was the most profitable quarter for any company in the world ever to date. They made an simply astounding amount of money. Up to this point, they've had the best quarters out of any company in America for quite a while. They hold like the top six positions as far as best quarters go. But up to this point, the different oil barons around the world had managed to trump Apple on dollars earned. But as of this week, that is no longer the case. Silicon has finally passed oil as your number one cash crop, as it were. And yeah, they made what was it? 70 or how many? Oh shoot, I had the number.
It's like 75 billion, right?
Yeah,
they profited 18 billion.
Yeah, their cash hoard is now sitting at a pretty 180 billion. They're just money, not doing anything with it. Having a good time.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. Just I'm trying to figure out the best way to put this into perspective.
It's hard to understand how much money that is because of how much the federal government spends on stuff, where they trump it by a full 10 times, you know, and or more. But
let me attempt to do
okay.
This. I'm going to try. I don't think I'm saying anything I'm not supposed to.
Awesome. I'm excited now.
Apple's profit, the money that they got to keep, that they got to hold because they didn't have an expense for it, is three times as large as what HP earns from ink sales before expenses.
So gross versus net. Apple's net is three times bigger than HP's gross.
For ink only. HP's a big... Yeah.
But still, ink is legendarily the buoy that holds up the entire company during bad times. It is the cash cow that keeps on giving. It is the golden goose, as it were. And yeah.
Apple has a bigger goose.
Yes. Apple with their cash hoard of $180 billion, if they could patriate all the money, would be able to buy Visa or MasterCard. They could buy Amazon and Netflix. they have so much money, it is impossible to wrap your head around exactly how much money they have. It is beyond astounding. And what's really fascinating to me is from the stock perspective of just how people keep on betting that it won't happen. And it's funny, so this is a quote that I thought was really interesting from this article. It seems insane, but it's really not that dissimilar. So the idea was, And then, so, okay, Apple made some money this quarter, but next quarter they'll fail. Okay, Apple made some more money this quarter, but now next quarter they'll really have to fail. I experienced it again yesterday. After reporting on Apple's quarter, I was told it was just a temporary blip. Pent-up demand for bigger phones that now exhausted will leave Apple to the, quote, once again plummet in the market. It seems insane, but it's really not that dissimilar to a certain kind of gambling mentality. Some people see Apple as betting on the same thing quarter after quarter, year after year, and they figure Apple's luck just has to run out. The more Apple wins, the more they believe the odds stack against Apple, and the more likely they think it is the company has to lose. And soon, every time Apple wins, they not only expect the loss to be inevitable next time, they want it to be. The problem is, Apple isn't betting, they're investing. Which I think is, you know, man, it's a crazy place that they're in, because I get that feeling too. It's sort of like, you know, when you start to compare them to who they're being compared to, you know, these giant oil companies, these giant whatevers, like, you federal governments, they've got more money than many federal governments, and around the world. And they just, when you think about how much money they have, when you think about how much money they're making and how much they're profiting, yeah, there is a real question of, like, how does this continue? You know, it's one of the big deals that everybody's been talking about is the Apple's now shipping as many phones as Samsung. You know, and Apple has always said that they're not in a game for market share. They're in a game for profit share. They want to make the most money out of everybody. They don't want to have the most phones. And so, and they've been able to do that for a long time. And now all of a sudden they're starting to encroach on winning the, slowly coming up on winning the market share debate too. It's just an astounding thing that they're doing. And the point that I think everybody kind of misses is that so long the company had been, pitched as Steve Jobs' machine. It was Steve Jobs' vision. It was Steve Jobs. And they don't really get enough credit for their whole Apple University thing. The idea that there's a business mentality that Steve Jobs pioneered and he crafted and perfected over the course of his lifetime. And as things settled down, he wanted to share that mentality so that it could be infected in the entire business apparatus, a company that was growing too big for him to personally maintain every aspect of it. So you just let those mentalities sort of like shuffle through, and they came up with Apple University, and it's freaking worked.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of when we were in Mexico building houses, and there was the year that you and I were on the same project, and one could argue that we were on the same project, which is why it went so well, which I think plays a key role too, getting the right people.
Yeah.
But one of the things we said when we started was we do not care about speed. We don't care about how fast we build this house. We want it to look awesome. We want it to look amazing and to be the best house we can build. We're going to measure everything twice. We're going to think before we cut. We're going to line it all up. We're going to take our time and do it right. You know, and there was a saying, right? It's like, good enough for Mexico. We went, no, that's not our standard. Our standard is much higher than that. And we slowed down and we took our time and we built a fantastic looking house. If I do say so myself.
Yeah.
But the other surprising thing that we did not expect is that we finished a day early.
Yeah.
We finished before everybody. And you wouldn't have known that, you know, with the way that we were talking and our attitude towards it, we weren't even watching the time. We didn't care. We figured it would get done when it got done and it would look amazing. And for us, it came down tactfully where we weren't making mistakes. We were thinking it through. And so we did only cut once and we didn't have scrap pieces and we didn't have to spend an hour going, huh, how are we going to make this work?
right.
You know, the door isn't plumb. Can we fix that? The door was plumb. And so all you did was you installed the door. And there's some real benefits, some real life benefits to that. And I think Apple has taken that to a degree that is normally not seen, where they sit there and say, we don't care about market share. We don't care about speed to market. We don't care about being first. That's not important to us. We care about quality, about not making mistakes, about doing it right the first time, and then moving on to do it even better and better. And that's always been their strategy, and it has been a very, very long, slow clap. But it's one of those where you get to the point where you go, oh, geez, we're like ahead of everybody here. How did that happen? We weren't even trying to do that. And you celebrate the success, and, you know, we thought it was cool. And, you know, and I think, you know, and then people get lulled into the idea of like, oh, yeah, we got to go fast, you know, because that's what works. And, you know, and that's where the bragging rights are. And, you know, it's about being the fastest and the biggest and the best. And like in Mexico, it was all about, remember, the competition was always like who could finish first.
Right.
And it was always comparing, like, well, where are you at in your project? What phase are you at? Oh, you got this up. Oh,
well, and in our defense,
that's not what you're competing on.
I think what's interesting is that is where that comes from. I don't think it was necessarily, you know, the competition, because it's for people who don't understand what we're talking about. James and I, over the course of 7 years, went down to Mexico with a group of similarly aged kids, and we would build houses, and usually two or three at a time. So we'd have different teams, and they were small shacks, these one room, like,
we're talking 12 shacks. By 12s. Yeah.
But they had a window, they had a door, they had a roof. It was, you know, and we were building these for your extreme poor. So that was the context of it, right? You could build them in 5 days, and we had 5 days to build them. And that was the point, is that there was an incredible, we were only there for a week, you only had 5 days, and they traditionally took 5 days to build. So it was like, there was a huge time crunch. So everything was built, or was all of our mentalities were around the idea of, can you finish in time? So getting done early was a huge success because you got to relax, or you got to go help somebody else who was falling behind. So everything in the mentality, because time was our biggest restraint or constraint, that was what we focused on. That's what we competed for. And finally, you know, you and I, the year that we did it, what we realized is we can do it in 5 days, period. We've proven it to ourselves. We've done it enough times where we know how to build these houses. So let's stop leaving problems behind and not fixing them. Let's fix every problem. Let's do it right. You know, and the whole thing that always bothered me was when studs and when the seams of where the big pieces of, like, plywood would go and a stud was, they didn't line up. So you could see seams. And it bothered me. It bothered me every year that we did it. And finally, I had an opportunity. I know how to prevent that. So let's prevent it. And we did. And you end up with this really, you know, well-built house that, like you said, got done super fast. It got done in a snap. And because you don't go back and fix it, because we stopped focusing on the biggest, our worst time constraint, and our worst constraint, which was time. And Apple, I think, has done, like you said, they've done the same thing. They stopped worrying about being first to market, about having the biggest market share, because they had proven to themselves over time that you can survive without it. You know, you don't have to be.
Yeah.
The mentality had always been everybody but Microsoft died. And Apple said, well, not everybody. We didn't. Everybody else did, because they were trying. They thought the only important thing was to have a giant market share, because market share allowed it, you know, it gave you the network effect. And that's what everybody wanted. But Apple believed that if you had fanatic users, it doesn't matter if it's a small group, it's enough to allow you to survive. So everything they've always done has been built around building up fanatic users. And if you have a small group of fanatic users, that you can make a living with that. You know, we talk about that all the time with, like, how do you get a podcast to succeed? How do you get a website to succeed? Well, you need 1,000 fanatic users that do that, pay for everything. Then after that, every step of growth you make is whatever. And Apple realized, hey, if we can build a small group of fanatic users, we can keep this company alive. It worked for a very long time. And when they slowly started to create even better devices for that small group of fanatic users, that small group of fanatic users started to proselytize. And all of a sudden, they're you know, singing Apple's praises, and they're growing the user base without Apple having to do it themselves. And pretty soon, you know, you've got a giant group of people that are fanatic users. And at some point, you do tip into the realm of Apple territory. You know, you focus on being really great for a small number of people, and it gets bigger, you know, and I don't know. I
totally agree with you. Now, having said all of that and the praises that we give them and the financial results, they deserve it. Just like whoever wins tomorrow will deserve to be called the best.
Yeah.
or whoever won yesterday, I guess, for those of you listening.
Right, yeah.
I still think they have a problem.
Yeah, what's that?
And this is going to sound weird to say, but it's like, they definitely focus on quality. They do a good job with that. And they, I'm not going to say they got lucky and picked the right product category, because I don't think that's the case. I think they did their research, and granted, there was some intuition there as well on Jobs' part. But I also think there was a timing aspect to it that worked out. That's working out very well for them. The chances of them creating another iPhone-like product, it's just like, I get that we just read this article that says don't bet against them. But it's like, what are they going to next? Oil, it's not as big. Banking, not as big. They literally are now bigger than everything else. What has to come next is something that hasn't been invented yet, which I guess, you know, that's what they stake it all on. I get that. But it's like the iPad, clearly not the iPhone. The iWatch will clearly not be the same size as the iPhone, which I get it where it's like for Apple, or at least the executive staff, they're okay with that.
Yeah.
They don't care about shrinking, right? They're like, as long as we're delivering the best products, we don't care.
Yeah.
Wall Street's obviously going to feel very different about that. And are they you're going to start to hear, you know, off with Cook's head when it starts to fall back down to what should be a normal level, or, you know, when the, not a normal level, but when the product cycle starts to end, and it's just, there's nothing that's this large.
Yeah.
And which I want to leave the possibility out for today, and that, you know, there is something out there, you know, because smartphones did exist beforehand, MP3 players did exist beforehand, and then Apple came along and, you know, did their thing, and all of a sudden it's, you know, it blows up. And so the potential exists that there's something out there, but there's literally never been anything in history that has been this.
Yeah.
And which, you know, I'm going to hedge and say, you know, it could. But I think they have an issue where when this product lifecycle finally dies down, and I think we're talking like 10 years into the future, don't get me wrong here, I think we got a ways to go. But I don't think investors are going to have the fortitude to go, yeah, you know what, they're okay with quality. They're still making the best products. They still have a high market share. They're just shrinking.
That was a gift that Steve Jobs had to he never fought with activist investors. They left him alone as the company was skyrocketing. It wasn't until Tim Cook took over that the Carl Icahns of the world got involved in the company and started to try to manipulate the stock and get things to happen that they want.
Yeah, and that's because Cook doesn't play the game, and Jobs was, you know, someone would start up that track and and he'd send out a one-liner email saying, this person's an idiot, and he'd be done.
Yeah, yeah. Steve Jobs was Steve Jobs.
Yeah, but, yeah. So, I don't know. It's one of those where I'm – it's not this year. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, I get
but
the
– did you read the – sorry, I didn't cut you. I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
I'd say I do get the feeling in to kind of echo that their next step is to become – a Sony Samsung-esque company where they do a lot with many different divisions. And if you can kind of
never see them doing that.
But it's the only way to get bigger.
But I don't think they do not feel that pressure to get bigger.
That's my point. Yeah, and I agree with you. And that's the thing, is that it just seems so out of character for the company, and yet it's the only option. It's the only thing that you can do next is to get involved in other things.
And that's why they have this huge cash flow. Because they're we're not going to spend it.
I will say this. You do see them doing the verticals where they're buying companies, and this actually will come back around later. I don't know if you've got another point, I guess it'd be a good time, because this will lead into my next story. But
my whole point was, you know, the next product thing taking off, and I did make the comment that I don't think the iWatch will be as big, which I still believe that. But there was an article of a guy who saw one just randomly in a subway.
Yeah.
And he goes, clearly, you know, Apple employee testing the product out and whatever. And he goes, He was like, I don't really have any interest in it other than I'm a tech columnist and I'm, you know, I'm in the tech. And he goes, and I saw this thing on this guy's wrist and I saw a couple notifications and the way that it worked. And he goes, I have to have one. He goes, yeah. It's that exact same feeling I had the first time I saw the iPhone in person. And he's like, and I went out and bought one. He's like, it just looks like it. Just that feeling of, oh man, I want one. Yeah. Like, it's going to happen all over again. He goes, you can just see it.
But, yeah. Hey, well,
you know, without subsidies, it's going to be a different game.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I was going to say is, you know, one of the things that Apple can do next is what the giant car companies of the past did, which was the verticals, you know, it costs too much to buy steel for, you know, the model for Ford to buy steel from other companies. So what do? They created steel foundries and they did all, you know, and it costs too much to buy rubber for their tire. You know, it's cost too much to buy their tires from other people. So what do? They built a tire shop and it costs too much to buy rubber for their tire shop. So what do? They bought rubber, you know, production facilities.
Vertical integration. Classic business strategy.
Classic. And what does that eventually do? What eventually happens is those companies become great in their own right, and they overproduce. And so now, on top of having the vertical integration, being able to, you know, to sell to yourself the cheapest, it also becomes, you know, advantageous to sell to other people because you have excess product. And that's how Samsung and Sony were created, right? Not necessarily this idea right. that they started building integrated electronic systems and then they got into chip manufacturing as a way to lower the cost of their own bigger manufacturing goals. And you can see Apple doing that. You can see that with, you know, the biggest failure example lately is the one that everybody's paid attention to, which is with the Sapphire Glass. But that is just one small piece of them doing this. They've bought a bunch of manufacturing companies where they're building the tools that build, you know, the different computers that they have. They're buying other, like, RAM companies. They're buying their own chip design companies. They're getting into the vertical integration so that they can make the iPhones cheaper, you know, cheaper to manufacture, so that they can put more into them than anybody else can, because they can do, you know, because they can afford it. And then the other big place that you've seen this is like with the Touch ID. The fingerprint scanner on that was a company that they bought. They own. They are only manufacturing for them. The advantage there for Apple is that it's the cheapest for them. They can afford to do it. The disadvantage to everybody else is that now Apple owns this company, and if this was legitimately the best company in the world to do that, which the general consensus is it was, now all of a sudden they don't provide for anybody else, and this is really fascinating. The Nexus 6 was supposed to have a fingerprint scanner. It was supposed to have one specifically in the back. There's a little divot in the back that's there for, like, you to hold, you know, put your finger there to balance the phone, is what they argue, which actually makes sense. If with those bigger phones, it's nice to have that, especially one as big as that phone. But they're like, but that wasn't the only thing that was supposed to be there. It wasn't just supposed to be a divot. The reason there's a divot there is because it was supposed to be a fingerprint scanner. Specifically, it was supposed to be the fingerprint scanner from the company that Apple bought. But Apple bought it, and now all of the other manufacturers of that type of technology, your capacitive touch finger that are sensitive enough to do fingerprint scanning, they can't compete with what Apple has. And, you know, so that's, you know, that's the other side of this equation, is just beat down your competition, do it cheaper than anybody else can, and, you know, get into that race. I don't know, it's cool. It's pretty fun to watch.
I was meeting with a property manager last week, and I need to email him, and that's exactly what he's doing. It was kind of like, whoa, you can do this in other areas? That's kind of crazy. Where he ended up buying a carpet cleaning company.
Yeah.
He's like, it's kind of cool. Now my properties all get priority, and I get it cheap.
Right.
And he's like, and we clean carpets for other people too. It's also another source of revenue, which is kind of nice. And I was like, why did I not even think of that? That's an amazing idea. And yeah, and now he's like, yeah, now I'm on the lookout for a landscaping company.
Oh, and, nice.
Because he goes, I got like four right now that I'm using to do all my properties. And like, it'd be nice just to own it. And then they could just do it, and we could do others. I'm like, that's a brilliant idea. But yeah, no, it's kind of crazy how they, you know, and what the interesting part about Apple though is they don't open it up. They go, okay, it's just for us now.
Yeah, yeah, and I wonder how long
enough money, we don't care.
Yeah, I wonder how long they can continue to do that, because that's obviously their one of their big advantages right now is that nobody else can do it. It's not just that they do it the cheapest. And eventually I think what will happen is you'll finally see that down cycle, the lack of the iPhone. They'll have to patchwork together the sort of growth that they had always seen, like with the, they'll have to patchwork the iPhone, the Apple Watch, the iPad, and whatever the cool product categories that they have that aren't making as much money as the cash cow that was the iPhone alone made. And then at that point, that's when the activist investors will get in and say, look, you've got all of this extra capacity. Why not sell some of this and make a couple extra bucks on the side? And then all of a sudden, you'll see a tremendous amount of pressure for Apple to expand and become just a giant manufacturing conglomerate that...
Yeah, what you'll find too is, I mean, and we're talking like 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
Down the line here. But what you'll also find is Cook will retire eventually. And then, and, you know, he's second generation leader, kind of. We'll call him second gen of the new Apple. And then you're going to get someone else in there who just thinks a little bit differently than they did.
Didn't know Steve Jobs as well. Doesn't revere him.
Yeah, if ever. Yeah. Yeah. And then we'll go down that classic path. So we'll see it happen, but we got time to enjoy our devices for a while.
Well, and I would sit there and I would say it's not even necessarily a bad thing for Apple to do. I mean, it's a big enough company that if they are good at whatever the spirit of Apple is, if they're good at disseminating that to people, if they figured out how to sell that idea on top of all their other products, it's something that can be carried out to the manufacturing world. It actually might be a good news for everybody if all of a sudden, you know, everything Apple does gets treated that same way. I'm not a knee-jerk, well, because they've got so many different, because they've got so many different distractions, that inevitably means it'll be a bad thing. I don't think that's necessarily true. But, I don't know. Yeah, definitely interesting to watch. Like you said, it's over the next 10 years. It's not a today thing.
But you know what? Today, they should be drinking champagne and having fun because they killed it last quarter. Pretty cool. Still worth the celebration. I mean, the equivalent of saying, I don't know if the Seahawks are going to be as good in 5 years.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Eventually, they're going to have to – their coach is going to retire.
Yeah. Like, yes, that's how this works.
Yeah. Congratulations. Business cycles.
All right, dude. We have spent – oh, I love it. We're so good at this.
We got through. We do this on purpose. We pick four articles we're going to spend most of our time on. That's exactly what we did. So let's run through the. You know, we got 20 minutes to run through the rest of them.
I love it. So again, I'm going to keep pushing this, dude. Tumblr could be your next thing.
Tumblr. All right,
Tumblr. So Tumblr is trying to make their writing interface and design aspects of it a little bit more slick and awesome.
Yeah.
Very similar to Medium. And I had this thought where I was like, is Tumblr MySpace and is Medium Facebook? Where Tumblr gets bought by a company and you just kind of watch it do its thing, whatever. And then you have this other company that's autonomous that just shoots up and just takes over. Because they essentially do the same thing, and Tumblr lets you customize everything, and Medium does not. And I mean, even to the point of the URL, right? And so, like, jamesferlow.com is technically a Tumblr blog, whereas that I could not do that with Medium.
Right.
You know, in essence, you can write there, and it's a lot better interface. It's a lot slicker. It's a lot more uniform. You get that sense, and so Tumblr's making these changes and these little upgrades, and you're like, man, is this gonna be enough to, you know, really take on Medium? Medium seems to be growing big time, though. And again, Tumblr's huge. You know, they got like 400 million blogs on them or something crazy like that, whereas Medium's up to like, yeah, we've got like 200,000, and I don't remember the exact numbers. I should probably open up the article and see for reals. What they're,
yeah, it's funny. I don't. I feel like I'm sort of. I get what they are, but I don't get it. I don't know if I could explain it to people why they're awesome at all. I just understand functionally what they are, which makes me feel like I should get, you know, throw in just so that I can do precisely that. Figure out what the heck, what's the big deal, yo? Why is everybody involved? You know.
Oh, I definitely like. The more I watch it, the more I'm like, I like Tumblr because of the customization aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what.
You can import stuff in. You know, you can hook up if this and that to it. I don't think you can do that with Medium. It's not really an option.
Okay, I'm signing. So. I'm logging into Medium right now. Signing up via Facebook.
There you go. You're in Facebook, huh? Not Twitter. Interesting. You can do it. That's cool. Whatever.
Well, yeah, but what are we just talking? What have we been talking about all week? Yeah, I'm not using Twitter, man.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, I just, you know, Medium is tied to Twitter. That's all.
Is it?
The founder of Twitter started Medium.
Oh, I totally knew that. I didn't know that.
Totally knew that. Yeah. By the way, I got those numbers. Medium is sitting at about 17 million. Whereas Tumblr has 420 million. So, I mean, they're like, they're different.
Yeah.
They're very different.
Well, yeah, but so was, you know, Facebook.
Yeah, I know. It's like, one time Facebook was like this puny little thing that was only for colleges, and MySpace was amazing and taking on the world, and everything was customizable, and, you know, artists loved it, and Tumblr's customizable, and artists love it.
Right, yeah.
You just sit there and go, yeah, I can kind of see where this is headed. But Tumblr's a little bit smarter. They're starting to adapt themselves to the look of Medium, which I think will help.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. I'll check it out. I'll get involved. I'll throw my hat in with the Medium. I will say this, what's his name? To talk about politics just a tad, I was very disappointed to find out that what's his name? Geez Louise, Mitt Romney decided to not run for president, because I would have loved to see him and Jeb Bush fight each other, just because they hate each other. They hate each other so much. And I love watching really, really rich guys fight each other. Like, just that would have been wonderful from an entertainment perspective. I don't care if, you know, like, I don't want to get into whether or not they would have won. Just watching that would have been great in the primaries. But Mitt Romney decided not to run. The reason I bring this up is because he announced it on Medium, was where he posted.
Really?
Yeah, not Tumblr. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's definitely, there are cool kids that have taken notice of Medium. That's for sure.
Yeah, I follow a guy on Tumblr who writes his blog posts on Medium and then pushes them over to Tumblr.
Well, you know, that makes sense too. I kind of get that.
That's how I use it. It's an aggregation service.
Yeah.
Just like so, Twitter.
Isn't everything. If this, then that. So I so did you hear about, speaking of politics, did you hear about the White House, what happened to the White House lawn Wednesday morning?
I did. A little drone attack.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It was awesome. Some dude got wasty face at 3 a.m. with his friends on, I guess it was like Wednesday morning, decided to fly their $800 DJI drone around Washington, D.C., accidentally crash-landed it on the White House lawn.
Sure, it was an accident, yeah.
Well, I'm sure they were just like, woo, and then when it was all done, he texted some of his friends, like, laughing about it. Dude, I think I crashed my drone on the White House lawn. Woke up the next morning to seeing his drone on national TV as a, you know, and probably that's the worst hangover of your life, man. That's definitely that's a way to feel terrible about yourself. But I thought this was kind of cool. DJI, which is a Chinese company. I'm not sure why that's important, but everybody mentions it. had pushed out a firmware update for all of their drones that includes no-fly zones. So since all of these things are GPS controlled, so that you can, you know, they're more stable that way, you can literally put up geofences that basically tell you you're not allowed to fly in these areas. And so there's a long list of airports that are geofenced off from your DJI drones, but now so is DC, all of it. You will not be able to fly your DJI drones around the city of DJ or city of DC, which I think was funny.
That's kind of cool, actually. But
yeah, it's cool that you can do that. I do think it's, I wonder, because like we keep talking about this drone TV show that we want to do, and I keep doing research about the ways to do that, because it's like to get a I can't believe I'm about to say this on YouTube, but to get a drone that can carry a firearm is actually kind of expensive, because firearms aren't super light, and so you need something kind of a weighty machine.
And then we talked about
Yeah, exactly. Well, the kick isn't as big of a problem, because that's the stabilization and stuff. Like, they do kick, but we'd be using a small enough round that as long as it can pick it up and fly with it, and you're not at, because you don't want to be at the upper limit of what it can carry. You want to be in the middle. But it also has to be able to ideally carry a camera as well. So this is kind of a challenge. There are definitely drones you can buy outright that you can do this. I mean, like, that's not a problem at all. They're just expensive. They're like a couple of grand. So I've decided to look into, you know, how difficult would it be to, quote unquote, build your own drone. Like, you know, if you get controllers and this, you know, and you know,
BYOD, I like it.
Well, you know, it's one of the greatest times ever to get into
drones. Of course, to teach other people how to do it.
Well, all right. I'm learning a lot more about it, but so I'm trying to figure out a way to do it, because I'd like to keep each weaponized drone under $1,000. You know, ideally around $800 is sort of my that's a price point that you could get people to buy into. And at this point, it's $1,500 is kind of what I'm looking, if you're just buying stock stuff new. So
got to start somewhere.
Anyways, I've actually done a bunch of research, and DJI, one of the cool things that they do is they sell all of their speed controllers and everything separately. So you can build your own hardware using their logic controllers, or vice versa. You can buy their hardware and put your own logic controllers in it. I wonder if you'll find more and more of that sort of thing where people will – not, you know, you'll buy everything but the main brain, and then there'll be a non-DJI main brain that's compatible with DJI hardware and equipment. So now you can fly your weaponized drones over Washington, D.C. I don't know. It's an interesting dilemma. Other questions people have asked is why didn't they have some sort of a system to watch for that sort of thing? And I thought it was funny. I read somewhere that one of your intelligence agencies people basically came out and said, look, the problem is that we can see and shoot down things that small. We totally have the technology to do that. The problem is that that's things cool. that small also look, or, you know, when you're talking about something that small, it is very difficult to tell the difference between a drone and a seagull. So as to prevent Fair us enough. From slaughtering the bird life that flies around the White House, we just don't shoot anything down that's small, which is an interesting technological challenge that they're going to have to deal with relatively soon now that, you know, everybody's aware of the fact that, oh, yeah, you can just fly a drone into onto the White House lawn. But yeah, it's an interesting time to be alive with the whole drone stuff.
I'm waiting for a drone to come over the Super Bowl dome.
Yeah.
Just to get a sneak a peek inside what's going on there.
Probably. Well, I'm sure that might happen this year.
Cool, man.
But, and then, okay, so I got it. Oh, yeah. So did you hear that Texas Instruments announced a new mobile device this week?
Did they?
Yes. It's the Super Slim Graphing Calculator.
Man.
I don't know why, but I love these stories. It's just, I don't know. It just looks hilarious. Weird. Why does it look weird?
I don't know. It just seems too colorful to me.
Yeah. So it's the TI-84 Plus CE graphing calculator. It's got mm-hmm. a color screen. It's got
30% it's lighter and 30% thinner. Oh my gosh. Sound like yeah. I'm into an Apple thing here.
Right.
Having devotion.
It's got 6 times the memory. No. It's got 6 times the memory, too, so you can store more color graphs and images. And let's be honest, a fresh copy of Drug Wars for goofing off mid-class. I don't even know what Drug Wars is. I'm old enough where we didn't play Drug Wars. We played, like, blocks and stuff. It's a turn-based strategy computer game. Wow.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. It's just the reason I bring this up is mostly to just pontificate about when our graphing calculator is going to go the way of the. Every time I look at the TI-84 Plus, it just makes me think about like where we are in education. Like this can't possibly be what we're doing. This just can't possibly be it.
I don't understand your frustration.
Because it's like, okay, I'm an engineer. I never do math. Not anything that would require a TI-84 Plus. I guess what I don't understand is, like, I feel like your education should be based around learning how to use the tools that you're going to learn. It's like in woodshop. They don't start you off with hand tools. They start you off with power tools. They teach you how to use power tools, the principles of power tools. At some point, you do have challenges where you're made to use hand tools to learn how to use it and learn and to appreciate the power tools and sort of understand the full gamut of what you're able to do. But it's like I honestly feel like long division is something that you should teach to engineers at the college level. Like, I don't actually believe that you need to understand how to do division.
Long division, huh?
I really don't think you need to understand how to do, like, the basic math operators in order to be able to understand the importance and significance of this. And this is why I would say this. I have no idea how to solve a cosine. No clue whatsoever. But yet I use trigonometric functions all the time. And I don't actually understand, but they're just a black box to me. I understand mathematically and geometrically exactly how they're used and their principles and everything. No clue how to solve one. I'm sure I knew at one time. I actually have seen the expansion series, and so I know it's an expansion series. But like, I don't know what it is. I don't know how to do it. I don't know. And I wonder, you know, and maybe that's a little extreme perspective. I probably would encourage my children to learn how to do the basic math operators. But I really don't understand why we don't sit there and say a math education with a high-powered computational devices is important. They go hand in hand. That's what I do for a living. I use math. And I use a lot of crazy math. I use math that's not like – I'm not necessarily doing high-powered – like I'm actually not even using – I don't know. I do a lot of geometric math. Like that's what I do. I'm really good at it. But I'm better than everybody else because I never – I very rarely ever do dimensions. Everything I do is relational dimensions. I do a bunch of like equations of grab all these different dimensions – calculate this and then put it into as a function. This is how big this piece of metal should be based on these different parameters. And that way I change one or two dimensions and everything else scales the way that it's supposed to. And that's useful. That's really, really useful to know, but it doesn't require like actually doing the math. It requires me to understand what the computer's capable of doing and what the relational functions are supposed to be, like, which is a separate idea from being good at being able to do math. And, you know, it's separate from being able to do algebra well, which these machines are designed to just take you to the edge of, okay, it'll take care of the basic algebra, the basic trigonometry, but nothing more. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just when it starts to get exciting. That's just when it starts to get fun with what computers can do for you. Because past that is when it really becomes advantageous. Like, I don't know. I just – and not to mention the fact that it's like $100 calculator that uses 1990s technology. Like, come on. This just can't possibly be where we're at. That people's smartphones are way more powerful than their graphing calculator and cost less. Like, it just can't possibly be where we're at. And the only reason why it's like that is because TI has a monopoly on the market because every textbook is written to the TI-84, you know, map of buttons, and that way people are, you know, don't like, I get why we are where we are, and it just seems like we're trapped in the cycle of under educating for what the future is. Like, it just bothers me.
Four thoughts.
Okay.
Number one, I had no idea what you're talking about with the whole dimension stuff. So there's that.
Okay.
Second thought. Sounded complicated, but easy for you, so that's good. The second thought. In math, there are clearly two parts to doing math. I'm not allowed to say that. There is the problem setup and the, you know, defining the problem and figuring out here's the way to come up with an answer.
Yeah.
And then there's the computation of the setup problem.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes. I completely agree.
Okay, cool. Feel the need to expand upon that concept, but I won't. There's a TED Talk, by the way, where this guy talks about it. He talks about his like 6-year-old daughter who was doing calculus, essentially.
Whoa.
And she didn't know math, but she understood shapes and how they worked. And calculus is all about shapes and, you know, the interaction between them. And so he wrote this program for her to teach her calculus without having to get into the algebra and the geometry. And, you know what I mean? He was like, we don't need to. I have a computer for this.
Right.
And so you can teach someone the concepts and the relationships and how to solve things, and then say, like, I liked your cosine example, and then you take the cosine, and then you add them, and
yeah,
then you're done, you know, and then you divide them, and dividing them is, you know, you have this one number, you press the divide button, and then you have the other number, and you're done, and so you have that, and so there's clearly, you can separate those pieces.
Yeah, and
okay, and I would also agree that, you know, a fundamental understanding of the basics of arithmetic, I think, is critically important. I think there is value in everybody having the ability to add, subtract, multiply, divide. I think that's okay. You know, it's funny. Remember when I think you were like me, we took physics before we took calculus.
Yeah.
And, like, physics is all about calculus.
Right.
And our teacher, we would come up and we would be talking about rates of change. And
He would have to come up with.
Sorry, I got. He would show us, like, we'd do rates of change. I was going to come up with an example, but I can't think of one. We would do rates of change, and he would say, okay, now you're going to do this thing called a derivative.
Yeah.
To calculate the rate of change. He'd say, here's the shortcut. And he would, you know, do the number down, subtract one, you know. Yeah. And he would go, if you want to know more how that, he goes, if that works, go take a calculus class because they'll teach you. Otherwise, all you need to know, and we had an amazing teacher, he would pull out one of those little magic star wands for princess.
Yeah.
If you want to act like a princess. And he'd press the button and go, bling, and he would then smack the board with it and go, it's magic.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. And you know what? That was good enough to do physics. That was honestly all you ever needed to know.
And I would say the reason why you teach basic arithmetic, the reason why you teach math for the first couple of years is because it's learning is not just about what you're learning, but learning how to learn. And I think basic arithmetic is a great way to learn how to learn, however you want to teach that. And so I would argue that although I don't think it's necessary, I do think it's valuable to teach early on as part of a broader spectrum. And I do think there is value in understanding all of math, but I don't think you have to start teaching people until they get to college. Like, if you're in a field like high-powered, you know, computational mathematics or, you know, certain fields of engineering and stuff where math becomes important, that's when you get into explaining how exponents work. Like, up until that point, just explain the concept and have a computer do it. Like,
so I guess the question is, where's the line on, you got to teach some computation, I think, and some you don't. A, where's the line? And then B, you know, do we genuinely believe that society is ready for that level of division of skills? You know what I mean? Like, people will say, yeah, you know what I mean?
I would say this. I would think, yes, I do. I honestly do. I think what's going to happen, because I think we have that all over the place where there are fundamentals that we just skip and we're taught the high-level relationship without ever being taught the fundamentals of how you got there, not just in mathematics, but all sorts of computers. Like, is a perfect example of how we do computers right now, where it's like most people understand how computers work from a functional perspective, but so many people don't understand how they work underneath, and it's not until you get into high school or college that we actually start to teach, you know, the basics of that we start to actually teach how computers work. And even then,
you might just teach programming one layer down.
Right. I was going to say, I've made my free time about understanding the entire stack from the transistor on up. How does a diode work to how does it, you know, a computer function? I couldn't build a computer. I don't know enough to do that. I just understand, like, I'm a couple of degrees deep, but a lot broader. And that's the point, is these things are way too complicated to be able to understand it all. There are very, very, very few people that could start with silicon and boron and phosphorus and turn it into a functioning computer. I guess what my point is that if you don't, you know, we do this all the time in society. I think we're making a mistake by focusing so much time on being very proficient at being able to complete computations. I think all tests, you know, maybe you don't change math at all, like what classes you're teaching, but all tests are taught with powerful enough programs that all they got to prove is that they know how to apply the calculator at every stage. They never actually have to prove that they can do the computation without it until they get to a college level where you would actually have a class about, you know, non-calculator computation, where you take the calculator away, you get these really Like, you get the people who want to learn how to program, who want to learn how to do mathematics, and you have them do you start a course in, computational mathematics, where you basically start with, okay, none of you actually ever learned how to do long division, so we're going to start there. And then we're going to teach you how to do exponential math, and we're going to teach you how to do this, and we're going to teach you how to do all the things. We're going to teach you how to solve calculus equations long form. Because you might have seen the proof once back in high school, but nobody ever made you solve it, because why would they? That's stupid. You can just put in the derivative sign, and it spit out the right answer.
So someone like you would still have learned all of that. It just would have been after the fact.
Yeah.
Someone like myself would have at least learned the stats side of the world.
Exactly. And the rest of it, you just would have a computer that does it for you. In a world where you can just take a picture of an equation and it will solve the equation for you, why do we go through the hassle? Why aren't we focusing on training people for the world they're going to be living in 20 years, as opposed to the world that they were living in 20 years ago?
That's good questions.
Thank you. I like good questions.
You gonna homeschool your kid if you ever have one?
Probably. I don't know.
Those are good questions, man. I mean, and those are things that educators do think about, and you have a whole other set of issues on top of it, unfortunately. But
that are not
tech and math related.
I know. I've got this. I've actually got this really weird idea that I probably should get into at another. I'll have to get onto another show because when we have more time. But about language and about the future of language and what happens when computers are smart enough to translate any language, in real time, because you get some really, 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 really interesting larger questions about what is language, what are cultures, and what happens when, the quintessential example of the Babel fish from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy can translate any language from any species, from any planet, and they can all communicate. You know, there's some weird things that happen at that point that you can do to teach and educate, and then all of a sudden, the spark of an idea is it a different language? Somebody who has an English education in literature and arts on doctorates in English literature versus somebody who hasn't graduated high school, do they speak a different language? Could a computer translate the language for them? And a sufficiently smart enough computer, I would argue yes. And I would say, do you get to a point in the next 20 years that somebody could stand up on a podium, presidential candidate could stand up on a podium and speak at whatever level he wants to speak at that he's comfortable with, and that each person in the audience would have it translated to whatever level of English they understand?
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's and then all of a sudden you ask the question of what happens if you throw in every 10th word is a word that the computer knows that person doesn't understand. And so they slowly can build up their vocabulary. It'd be a pretty cool function, and it seems sort of inevitable that you would do
that.
That's
interesting. I went a very different direction where everything becomes double plus good.
double plus good. It could go either direction. I mean, and that's the thing, is that it's a weird question when you get to that point, that everybody speaks our own language. We have our own vocabulary. And if a computer's smart enough to hear what you're saying and understand the level of your vocabulary and your language level, could it teach you Spanish without you even knowing it?
So there's a video. Jimmy Fallon was interviewing the guy from Hunger Games,
Pita Bread.
Pita, thank you. Pita Bread, yeah, that guy. That actor, and apparently he had a childhood friend where, like, they invented their own language, so that they could talk to each other. And he speaks it on the interview. I'll have to see if I can find the video. It's kind of amazing, and you listen to it and you go, that literally is gibberish. He goes, yeah, I know, but I understand it.
That's
kind of crazy.
That's crazy. That's crazy. One, it's,
you sit there and go, you know what? You're actually a lot smarter than you seem.
Yeah. There's enough idiots in Hollywood that you're really surprised when you remember that some of them aren't.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, ah, oh, jeez. I've been in your own language. That actually takes time.
That's cool.
And he speaks fast, too.
That's a Tolkien-esque thing to do. But anyway, so... So the last story I'll talk about.
All right. I'll do one or two more.
Microsoft is investing in Cyogen, which is it's a fork of Android that's completely not controlled by Google. It's controlled by Cyogen, and Microsoft is investing in them.
Microsoft hates Google so much. I love it.
I would say everybody's sort of like, "Oh, why are you doing that, Microsoft?" And Microsoft's like, "Well, we've got our own reasons," and everybody's reading between the lines, which is they just hate. They hate Google, and they hate that Android is winning, and so they're going to start funding the competition just to throw a wrench into the Google works. It's kind of awesome. I love it.
I love it. That's so funny. Microsoft. There's a competitor. Jeez. Yeah,
right?
No one says we can't. We're going to do it. It's going to be great. That's so funny. So Microsoft... that wasn't the only thing that they did this week. So apparently they bought the company called Acompli, which is an email system. So right now, the best Gmail app, or the best app for reading your Gmail on the iPhone, is made by Microsoft, and it's called Outlook. Because they bought Acompli, and then did a little bit of tweaking to it, renamed it to Outlook. And from all the reviews that I've been reading, they're like, yeah, this is the best. It works the
really?
Best. Really? Of everyone. Yeah, they're like, Google's Gmail app is not worth a download. They're like, the built-in one's okay.
Really?
I gotta
try other stuff because I like Google's app, but...
You should check out Outlook. Outlook for iPhone. I heard right? It's pretty good.
Yeah. But, evidently, I'm a rube. I did not know that.
What?
A rube? A rube? R-U-B-E? Like a Reuben sandwich?
Yeah.
It's somebody who's uncultured.
Oh.
It's okay. Kind of a... Yeah, it's a bit of a pejorative. A country bumpkin is what Google defines it as.
Why do you think you are?
Because I use Google, I use the Gmail app.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. There you go. I'm like, I don't understand why you're telling me this. But okay. Gotcha. Yeah, no, you should check it out, man. You should check it out. Apparently, it's pretty good. Like, on one level, you're like, again, it's kind of nice to see they're all playing nice, but we know that's not happening.
Yeah.
That probably won't last. But hey, do you travel much for work?
Yeah, I'm actually going to England in a week.
Well, I mean like driving, I guess, mileage tracking type stuff.
No.
Okay, never mind. I was going to tell you all about Mile IQ. Essentially, it's a service that tracks your mileage for you on your phone, and so it creates a trail and everything, and then it can sync up with the accounting system so that you can get your mileage accounted for.
Like it uses GPS and stuff?
Yeah, from your phone. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's really cool. That makes sense.
Yeah. They say on average, people underreport $500 worth of miles a month.
Holy cow.
I'm like, well, they got the high users, obviously. But so they'll charge you like $5 a month to use the app, which you're like, oh, I'm getting that back. Sure.
Yeah.
You know, because tracking your miles is a pain in the butt. I technically cheat because what you're supposed to do is, you know, however you do this, you write down your starting miles when you start your journey, and then you write down your ending miles when you end your journey. And that's what you're supposed to do. For every single time you do a business trip, you know, driving-wise. I don't do that. I use Home Depot as a proxy. Every time I go to Home Depot, I go, oh, I drove there. I just look up the miles on Google Maps from my house and go, that was it. And it gets me close. But I'm clearly under-reporting, and I get that, and I'm still kind of figuring out, like, I drove the apartment building like pretty much every single day this last few months. And like, does that count or not? I don't even know.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's actually for tax reasons, right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, that's all about, because you get reimbursed. It's some ridiculous amount. It's 57.5 cents for each mile you drive.
Holy cow, that's a lot.
Yeah. So, like, for example, whenever I have to travel for HP work, I'll drive up to the airport and then drive back, and I tell HP, here's how many miles I drove, and then HP actually reimburses me that amount because it's just kind of a pass-through for them.
Right.
Because then it's an expense to them, and then they get to write it off. And, I make, like, $97 every time I go to the airport.
Wow.
Yes, granted. I did pay for gas, but I drive a Prius. It's okay. Yeah.
I was going to say, the thing is, I was going to say, the reason why the reporting is important is because, you lie to your company, you get fired. You lie to the federal government, you go to jail.
Yeah, that's true.
So accuracy is important. If you're going to estimate incorrectly, I want to underestimate.
Yeah, and that's why I always pick, like for me, it's like every time I go to Home Depot, clearly I was driving for my business. It's an obvious, easy tie, and I can, I can semi-easily defend it. They may not like the way I do it, but you know what? I'm lazy. That's okay.
This is what happens.
So there you go, dude. That's what we have going on.
I like it.
Hope you all enjoyed the Super Bowl. Congrats to you winners out there. You know who you are. And, dude, good stuff going on. Let me switch the audio over real quick. All right. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. We really do appreciate it. You're listening to episode is this? 175. 175 of Bros Tech Podcast. Pretty cool. We really do appreciate it. If this is your first time listening, we have at least 174 other episodes that are pretty cool. You can find them all on our website, furloughbros.com. And along with the show notes for this particular episode, I think if you just search for 175, it'll show up. I don't know. It'll be the top one. That's us again. Thanks for listening. We love it. I am James Furlough. My brother on the other side of the line of scrimmage, did I get that right? Is Matthew Furlough. And so we will talk next time. Thank you.